It is Saturday, April 6, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe. He's a web instructor and world traveler.
Good morning.
And Bonnie Jean Premsch, broadcaster at large, mediator, and printmaker.
Here I am.
Did you like my intro, please keep in mind the view express? Did you understand any of that?
No, yeah. But we all know what that means.
Okay, good.
Right, gang?
Yeah.
Right,
what we say is kind of our stuff and our ideas, yeah. And not anybody else's. Ben, dark matter?
Sure. All right, so what is dark matter? Dark matter, we have all the stuff that we can touch, that we can see, that is all of our, what we call baryonic matter. In the way of non-baryonic matter, this is a bunch of matter in the universe that we can't see, we can't really detect in any way, in hardly any way, aside from gravitationally. And it turns out that the majority of the matter, like 80% of the matter in the universe, is non-baryonic matter. So not the stuff we're made of, but this other stuff, we call it dark matter. And this has been theorized, and mathematical models have shown it and whatnot. And there's actually a $2 billion particle detector that we recently attached to the International Space Station. And it has detected the potential signature of dark matter, which is pretty fantastic, dark matter annihilation. So the idea is that when these dark matter particles collide, now we don't see it with light or anything like right. that, because it doesn't interact. It's called dark matter for a reason. It doesn't give off any kind of light or EM radiation. But it does give off some particles. So we've got electrons and positrons. Positrons are anti-electrons, if you will, right?
Okay.
Antimatter. And our sensor, called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, has detected a whole bunch of positron detections, 400,000 positron detections, which have been confirmed to be of energies consistent with what we think it would look like if dark matter smashed into itself.
Okay, so our current theories of what dark matter is, which is non-baryon-based particles. We won't go into the details of that because we can't.
Baryonic versus non-baryon.
Exactly.
Too much detail.
But it's it has to do with the quark count inside the particle or something.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Crazy stuff.
So when the theories we have that describe dark matter, what they might be, would have a side effect of having this this positron flow, if you will, or this particle effect. Very cool. So antimatter signature happens to look like what one of our theories is about dark matter.
Yeah.
And so we've detected this now. This wasn't released on April 1st. This is like real.
Is this real? I'm so skeptical now.
No. This was not April 1st. This is April.
It's the week that embitters us all tech geeks. The one I thought saw that I just loved was a Play-Doh 3D printer, like a 3D printer
with
Play-Doh.
Cool.
Yeah, that was fake.
Yeah, the one that I really liked is CERN, the particle collider. The headline was CERN gives away Higgs boson particles to 10 lucky winners. if anyone's been following that, how ridiculous that is.
But basically, we have more evidence that dark matter is a real thing.
Yeah, we actually have some good evidence. Now, before we had some clues kind of showing this dark matter signature, we had an instrument called PAMELA, which is actually an acronym for a really long thing. I wonder how long they sat around a table trying to figure out a good acronym.
Make it spell a word.
But it's like the Patriot Act, right? Like that's actually an acronym.
It is.
I'll Google it.
No, don't. No, go on. Finish your dark matter story.
But anyway, their measurements were consistent with dark matter, but they were very coarse measurements, right? So they weren't specific enough to say, yeah, this really looks like dark matter.
It's roughly dark matter shaped.
It kind of looks like, you know, if it looks like dark matter, you can't see dark matter. So
right.
If it looks and smells like dark matter.
But now it actually quacks like dark matter also.
Yes, you can hear it. So now you know it really well.
But this is now, again, this is not 100% proof. This is just kind of science taking its normal course where we...
As it does.
evidence that's a little stronger, and then evidence a little stronger and stronger and stronger. One theory of what this might be is this might be a positron signal generated by pulsars, which are neutron stars that are spinning really, really fast. So, I mean, like, we need to do a little bit more work to confirm that that's not it, and that it might actually be dark matter. Mm. But it looks like some pretty good evidence that dark matter is actually what we think it is.
Very cool.
What happens when we know for sure that dark matter is what we think it is? Then what happens?
We jump up and down. We don't call it dark matter anymore. We call it something else.
We call it what it really is.
We have a better description for non-biotic matter, I guess.
Yeah, well, we've got our work cut out for us because, you know, there's matter that we are made of and that everything that we see and interact with is made of.
Star stuff.
There's star stuff. Yeah, exactly.
I love how you said it like him.
Fantastic. We're made of star stuff. No, that wasn't a good Carl Sagan impression.
Mine's better.
Yeah, yours is better. But he did something with his S's, right? Then we have dark matter, which is what we're talking about. And then we have the majority of the universe, which is made of dark energy. Now, what is dark energy? Yeah, we have no idea. What it does, but we have no idea what it actually is. So it's kind of fun. I love science.
Dark matter, you guys.
So my friend and friend of the show, big friend of the show, Jim Warner, has written up this wonderful... He's over the years, Jim's the network expert in the area. He works at UCSC and was a colleague of mine until I left there. One of the sad things about leaving UCSC. And Jim's got this amazing knowledge of networking protocols and a whole bunch of the stack. And one of the things he's been working on is the cell phone coverage area. And I think I've covered this on the show before. So there's the organization, the California Public Utilities Commission, is an organization that kind of tries to deal with public utilities. And one of those, of course, is network and cell phone usage. And of course, the cell phone usage information is based off what the carriers say. So to determine if we have coverage in a certain area, you kind of go pay attention to these companies. But of course, the companies are all competing with each other to get customers, and customers want good coverage area. Mm-hmm. So you really can't trust the maps that they provide.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So how do you do it? Well, you do a groundswell recording process. And so Jim's put up this great page. I've linked from geekspeak.org. It's a little bit long of the URL, but go to geekspeak.org, go to today's show, and you will find this information out. You know, Ben, would you publish today's show, make this show live? I'll do it in the second half if you guys can.
So are you saying this is sort of like a self-reporting, how your coverage is, and then you get an accurate map of what the cell phone coverage is for any particular company?
California Public Utilities Commission has released kind of a groundswell-developed Android application called CalSpeed, and it's now available in Google Play as of this morning. And you can download this and run it on your phone if you've got an Android phone. And as you go in different areas and as you collect information about kind of speed, it'll detect the coverage area, who's got availability, and it will give some speed tests as well. And all that data will get collected and added to our knowledge base. And Jim's page talks a little bit more about, you know, which 4G network is where, what network protocols are where, and really interesting maps, including files you can download to put into Google Earth to see the map coverage in Google Earth, which is really cool, KML files. So anyway, that's all up at geekspeak.org. And Jim, thank you for keeping the geeks up to speed on this, because it's wonderful to find out actually what's going on. And I've run some of these earlier apps. There's some iPhone apps that are kind of like this, but nothing that does that auto sync. Additionally, they're hoping to get 1,200 people to do this map coverage area.
Oh, so it's a call out for volunteers.
It is a call out. So I'm hoping that I've actually contacted the people that are organizing it and say, hey, come on the show, or at least talk to me about what's going on so I can talk about it more.
My phone's over here doing a test right now.
Oh, great, great. So we'll know what the coverage area at KOSP Studios, which of course is a block from the beach between 7th and 8th Avenue in Santa Cruz. Let's. One thing that I thought was an April Fool's joke was actually what you sent Bonnie when you said, take a look at this video, it's freaky. Will you describe the video?
Okay, so it appears to be just a short video of a robot working out.
Yeah.
Doing some stretches, a little light jogging.
As they do.
As they do.
It looked like it's one of those like guys in the movie set costume, you know, like the chem suit or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's like in a suit. And just kind of like stretching and working out and doing some knee bends and stuff. And I thought, what is this robot getting ready for?
It looked like a person.
It did.
I thought
like
it was a person at first.
Well, and what it, I know, really
a person
creepy,
pretending
smooth
to be a
movements
robot
and everything. But what it was actually doing is testing the suit. It was doing suit testing and sort of like wear and tear on a suit.
Right. And see, the reason I thought it was an April Fool's joke is that Boston Dynamics is well known for these creepy robots. And I say creepy because every time you see a robot do something that is like better than, I don't know, C-3PO, you go, not good. Yeah. Like they got this one that's called the Flea, which jumps on top of buildings. Because why wouldn't you want a robot that can jump on buildings?
Right. I mean, thanks to John for the reminder about that creepy robot.
And then there was that dog
one that just throws cinder blocks like they're nothing.
Oh, yeah. We've covered this on the show among clients. So when I see Boston Dynamics in a YouTube video, I'm like, okay, what's it now?
Yeah.
But this robot had no robotic nature in the sense that it was completely covered head to toe in cloth, and so you couldn't see any like, that's not a human.
It's like a
chemical
suit.
Oh, it's about to make into like a dance move. It's really a person, and it made it look, and that's why I thought it was an April Fool's joke. So halfway through the video, when I think, okay, now the person who's actually in that suit is going to do something that a robot really can't do, and instead the suit disappeared and it was a robot. I'm like, ugh. And of course the robot,
the sound of being creeped out.
Of course the robot's face, there's no sensors on it. It's just a blank face. Which is just creepy as well.
That's creepy. Also.
And the older, and I remember that robot. And it's called, what is it called?
Can we talk about Pet what
Man.
This robot
Pet
is actually Man. For?
Yeah, in a second.
First,
the emotion of being freaked out. The Pet Man, earlier Pet Mans I've seen, doesn't have a head. It just has like this kind of cage thing coming from its chest.
Yeah.
What's the robot? Why is it wearing a suit? Ben,
it's testing chemical. It's wearing a chemical suit. And it's moving around to test to make sure that chemicals don't get into the suit.
Right.
So it's got sensors in itself that test for chemicals. And then they clothe it in this suit thing. And then they release a bunch of, you know, noxious gases around it. And they check to see if the gases can penetrate the suit.
It's the noxious gas stuff that they haven't gotten to yet. In that video, they just have it wearing it. But theoretically, they'll put it in a chamber. And then they'll fill it with horrible corrosive nastiness, and it will dance around again, as it does. And then if
you can't
sense
kill me that way, Dave.
Yeah. So all they're doing really is just making sure the robot will be impervious to some types of weaponry, because of course that'd be great.
Chemical warfare. Yeah,
because that's next.
Preparing for battle.
He's doing important testing work that we don't have to do. He's protecting us.
Yes.
Why are you concerned, Lyle?
Stop talking so creepily. It's creeping me out. One of the interesting things about this robot, too, is that it simulates sweating. It simulates the kinds of things that a human body would do, too, to see what kind of an effect it would have inside of this crazy suit. But the weirdest thing, going back to the emotional impact, okay, the weirdest thing to me, I saw this video, but there's another video out there that you showed me, Lyle, this morning, and it's this robot, it's the same robot, it's walking on this treadmill, and it looks really menacing, like it looks kind of like some angry army guy walking, like with a wide stance and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the researcher who's like dressed
angry
in a t-shirt,
guy wide stance, yeah,
walks up to the robot on the treadmill and just gives it a shove.
Yeah,
and the robot is just like totally unaffected. It just kind of like deviates a little bit, regains its balance, but it never stops looking angry, army manny.
I'm gonna keep marching,
Ben. Yeah, that's your emotion, your sir.
Yeah.
It has no emotion, even when it's killing you.
This is how it made me feel, though.
You know, the big dog videos do that too. Somebody comes up and it's just like, oh wow, the robot's walking on a beach, and then they kick it and it like
it's like
you feel for it for a second and it pops back up, it's fine. You're like, that's not right.
Like that won't stop me, no.
Oh,
get
man.
The wooden stake.
You know, for when a couple years
where's the garlic?
You know what they should do is just all robots should have like a hole in a very obvious place that if you put a stick in it, it dies.
Ew.
Right? Just like that's a design. Absolute.
Just in case of the singularity.
All right.
Or like it reacts to your scream and it's like, oh, scream. That's my signal to shut down.
In the air with me is Bonnie and Ben. I'm Lyle. We're not taking calls today, but we're welcome to, and we invite you to email us at any time. And some of the content we actually provide on the show comes from emails. You can learn how to do that at geekspeak.org.
Yeah.
Also, everything we talk about is up at geekspeak.org. Stay tuned because we're about to talk about, of course, we got to cover a Facebook story, right? We will be covering a Facebook story. And we're also going to be talking about the new browser open source split that Google kind of announced this week and the kind of the effects. So stay with us here on KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. Ben Jaffe and Bonnie Jean Primsch are here with me. And I just want to tell you a little bit about open source because this is important for Ben's next story about, well, you'll hear. But basically, in open source projects, there's a whole bunch of people that get together for their own reasons and ideas and start programming complicated systems together. And there are a lot of really interesting tools to do that. Git is one of those ones that's really effective. A lot of this is about the communication between people, right? That's what it's about. And the side effect, the projects that come out of open source projects are sometimes really relied upon by large corporations. So examples of open source projects that you've heard of are like MySQL, Firefox, a lot of the parts of Safari, which is not a browser you're using. The Linux operating system is completely done by open source. And this basically means that everyone can see what's going on, and some people actually contribute. And the more people contribute, the more time and energy, of course, the faster the project goes. But large decisions have to be made in these projects, and they have to be done collaboratively. And it's a complicated current era communication system structure, and it only works really because of the computer systems that everybody's actually using to program and the way we're able to communicate. So complications arise, and that's what Ben's story is about.
Yeah, so we've had WebKit for a long time. WebKit is a browser rendering engine. It's been around since 2001, and it was kind of moving along, and then I think Apple joined it first, right?
I think Apple started it, yeah.
No,
they got it from a different group, and I can't recall it. It was an open source project.
It started with KHTML,
right.
And then it became WebKit. Well, in any case, the Safari web browser was based around WebKit, and WebKit is the thing that basically says, hey, here's some HTML, here's some CSS, I'm going to render the web page like this. Based on the standard and all that mm-hmm. stuff. Firefox uses a different rendering engine called Gecko. Opera was using one. I can't remember the name of that one.
Famously, Internet Explorer does not have an open source rendering engine, right?
It does
that's
not.
A proprietary.
That's the problem.
It's not exactly a problem. But
Trident.
Exactly. It's one of the, right? Trident? I don't know.
Yeah.
So we have...
Incidentally, yeah. Internet Explorer for Mac, the reason that browser sucked so much is it wasn't the same browser as Internet Explorer on Windows. It was a completely different rendering engine.
Right.
As far as I know, if my history is wrong, someone should email us. But I think that's the case.
So specifically, the rendering engine, this really is what paints the picture for you when you go to a web page.
Yeah.
So you
that's
go to a web page and it looks the way it looks. That's the thing that's the rendering engine.
Exactly.
Okay. And opposed to that, we've talked before about like V8, the JavaScript engines, and WebKit also has a JavaScript. That's the programming environment that's kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
That's a different open source project that's kind of pushed together in there.
It's like
but
the back office stuff.
It's like the engine of the car versus
the body of the
layout,
car.
The body,
yeah.
the body, the layout of the
good.
Car.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very incomplete metaphor, and don't take it very far.
So then
Google decided, hey, we're going to make a browser called Chrome, and it's going to be super awesome, and of course it is now. And they're on like version 24 or something. But that runs on, that uses WebKit, which is, again, this open source project that Apple uses for Safari. So Safari and Chrome were rendering all of their web pages using the WebKit rendering engine, right?
And is that why they look the same?
They almost look the same.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some Safari-specific code. There's some Chrome-specific code. Also, Google has a project called Chromium, which also uses WebKit. So a couple things happened this last week, actually, all right in a row, which has really kind of turned the web development community on its head a little bit. So Opera has been using their own Presto rendering engine for years.
Opera is another web browser.
So you've probably heard of Firefox, you've heard of Chrome, you've heard of
Opera,
Safari,
haven't heard of, I'm just
you've heard
say
of
that.
Internet Explorer, and it's then you have Opera. And Opera is, I think, bigger in the international community outside mm-hmm. of the United mm-hmm. States. They're also the smallest of the five fish, of the five browsers.
Of the five large ones, and there's others too, but we'll get into those.
And the others are very small.
Yeah.
So they made an announcement that instead of continuing with their own Presto rendering engine, which they have to develop and everything, they've decided, hey, we're going to jump on the WebKit bandwagon. And instead of using our own rendering engine, we're also going to use WebKit. Now, the really cool thing about all of these companies using the same rendering engine is that they all work on it. So
right.
Apple's engineers push changes to WebKit to make it better. Google's engineers do the same thing. And now Opera's engineers were going to do the same
thing. Yeah, and Apple and Google have been doing a lot of work on this open source project,
yes,
which is really neat to see.
And that's kind of why Firefox is struggling to keep up, is because, you've got
I'll take a challenge at that. I don't think Firefox is having trouble keeping up. They're doing an amazing job. Gecko is really quite impressive.
Absolutely, yeah. I would never denigrate
okay.
Gecko. Gecko is a fantastic layout engine, everything, and a wonderful browser as well. And they're doing an amazing job. But at the same time, it's really difficult to build a layout engine when you have another layout engine that Apple and Google, huge, huge companies with tons of resources, they're both putting a lot of energy mm-hmm. into them. So anyway, that's news number one is Opera is moving to WebKit, and people were like, oh, cool. I mean, cool, I guess.
There was a bit of concern.
Is that 100% good news? I mean, it sounds like it's the concern, rising of all the boats thing, but what's the cost or what's the risk?
And actually, that was a bit of the debate. I was at a conference about HTML this earlier in this week, and that was a bit of the debate of like, well, Opera's doing that means that there's less competition, right? There's Firefox, Internet Explorer, and
monolithic.
The WebKit, right? That's going to be it for the rendering engines. Well, that means that push from the side of the layout engines is not the same. Now, keep in mind also that the standards that we're all going towards, that all these are supposed to follow, is defined by a large organization called the W3C.
And the WHATWGA.
What's that?
And the WHATWGA. WHATWGA. I call them the WHATWGA.
Okay.
They've co-authored the HTML5 specification, for example.
Right.
So it's these two standards bodies.
Right. So these standards bodies are basically people that kind of volunteer the time or might get paid by their company to spend time declaring that, well, you know, when you put an image on a page, it should look like this. You know, that rule set. It's really quite complicated. These are large documents that they publish. And actually, earlier this week, Ben, I was added to the W3C. I'm going to be working in a project group on one of the working groups.
Huh?
It's really kind of cool.
Become them.
I'm just starting out, and it's definitely in my same bailiwick in the sense that it's like, you know, community driven and it's volunteer in a lot of sense and that kind of thing.
Well, I have a question about this, fellas. If the concern is that, okay, just a few big companies are going to be using WebKit, but WebKit is itself kind of a wisdom of the crowds, collaborative, open source thing, doesn't the fact that it's got a bajillion million minds working on the project kind of take care of the monolith
problem? Well, that's why it's so awesome. But keep in mind that even a crowd can make a bad decision. And if you have two crowds, and you know, one crowd goes one way and one crowd goes the other way, have more divergence, that more opportunity for learning. So that's potentially it. Also, when we say, you know, it's giant, massive, the teams are not, the developers that actually develop this stuff, they're not as big as we'd expect. Mm-hmm. You know, there's thousands and thousands of developers looking at it, and there's probably, you know, under 100 developers actually coding a lot of this stuff. So it's not massive, massive. But
yeah.
Ben, what then happened in the storyline this week?
That's part one, is Opera is on WebKit now, right? So everyone's like, whoa, that's crazy. But then something crazier happened. The Google... Then what happened?
Next week on GeekSpeak.
we'll just leave that. So that was, I think, on Tuesday. Maybe that was... I think that was Tuesday.
Yeah.
No, I think that was
whatever.
Monday.
What'd Google say?
So then like a day or two later... Google comes out with a blog entry. This is April 3rd. This is Wednesday, saying that they are moving away for Google Chrome and for Chromium. They are moving away from WebKit. They are taking WebKit. They're forking it, which means taking a copy of that code base, and they're going to work on their own version, which they're calling Blink. So basically, they're creating another rendering engine. Now, it's based off of WebKit, but here's some of the things that they were saying. They were saying like there's a lot of internal architecture improvements that they could do in simplification of the code base, because ultimately Chrome and Safari and Opera all work a little bit differently, right? Chrome has a lot of process independence and things like that, and it's difficult to do a lot of the things that they want to do in the WebKit architecture without messing up other people, right?
Right.
So that's some
customizing.
Of the difficulty. Yeah, so they're customizing, and they're going to, like, one of the things they said in their blog entry is, they said, for example, we anticipate we'll be able to remove 5 build systems and delete more than 7,000 files comprising more than 4.5 million lines of code right off the bat.
Right.
So basically, they can get rid of a lot of this, I guess what you could call cruft, and build a more streamlined browser. Now, Opera has announced that they're also going along with Chrome and Chromium and Google.
And you assume, Ben, that Opera knew about the split before they joined?
That's my guess. It's like,
it seemed like a good timing, right?
It seems a little coincidental that Opera is like, all right, we're moving to WebKit, and then Google is like, we're moving away from WebKit. You know, I think that there was a conversation going on behind the scenes before moves.
I was, of course, at this conference when all this stuff's kind of happening, or right after that, and thinking a lot about the community of HTML development. And this sounded very much like Google saying, well, if you're not going to play my way, I'm going to play by myself, and grabbing the ball and leaving, which kind of that felt like it. But as I'm reading up on what's going on, it really is clear that there's a lot of code that is inside the WebKit rendering system that is reliant upon, is there because of the support of these different browsers. And so, and then one of the things that is a great example of this, Alex Kormoska from Google Product Manager of the Open Web Platform team. So he works for Google, but he works on the WebKit and the other systems in the browsers. He says that, for example, we would like to run iframes in a different process, but that's something that's very difficult to do with WebKit right now.
What's
so those
an
kind
iframe?
Of so in a browser, one of the things you can do is you can put what's called an iframe. It's an inline frame, and what really happens is the browser says, "Oh, let me get another website, another web page, and put it inside this web page." That idea of page inside a page.
So you don't have to really go
right.
Or when you leave from there, you're still back where you started.
Yeah, so, and there's really interesting things you can do with that.
Okay.
One example that's used all the time is if you embed a YouTube video. Basically, what you do is you you put an iframe on the page, and it basically cuts out this little rectangle inside of your web page, and it says this rectangle is going to be this other web page.
Right.
And this other web page is the
right
YouTube
now
player.
When you do that in Safari or Chrome, if that other web page crashes your browser, if it causes a problem to your browser and your
then
browser
stops,
you
get that little message where there should be the thing that says,
right.
That didn't work.
Potentially
the entire page
would
down.
Go down, even though it's only a little subsection. So one of the things that Chromium likes to do is they like to split everything into multiple processes. So when one process goes over and crashes, it doesn't affect the other.
Everything.
So you'd have a more stable browser experience in an iframe situation. For example, now there's hundreds of them. That's one of the ones that we can clearly understand. There's other architectural decisions. And then additionally, we talked earlier about JavaScript engines being different. WebKit there is a WebKit JavaScript engine, and there's a V8 JavaScript engine, which is for the geeks out there. That's the one behind Node.js. In any case.
Also Chrome.
Chrome V8. As well. Chrome uses V8. That's why it get created, and then someone used it to produce Node, which is kind of a really different... Well, we won't get into that.
Yeah.
The point is that there's a whole bunch of code in the WebKit engine that supports both those JavaScript engines. And therefore, as the fork happens, as Chromium says, we're only going to use this one, mm-hmm. then the people most likely that will be using the V8 engine and what will be Blink, what was WebKit, will go on that side, and then both the code bases can be cleaned up because they don't have to support the other JavaScript engine.
So
that
a
divergence,
net gain.
It potentially could be. And Google's even saying, we'll even help the WebKit project get our code out of there. Mm-hmm. So it's not
friendly. Google saying, well, you know, forget you guys, we're going to do our own project. Two things. First of all, Blink is open source as well.
Oh, right.
So WebKit is open source, and they are working within the open source project. When I heard about Blink, I thought, oh boy, they're going to do their own proprietary thing. No. So Blink is actually
still for people to
So other people can submit pull requests, work on
see,
it potentially.
The thing that automatically comes to my mind is, wait, couldn't you have sub-projects out of the WebKit/Blink community that are shared? So like the thing that draws divs, or you know, some chunks of it could be the shared code base. It seems to me like making it more modular would make a lot of sense. So I'm curious about that part of the debate. But that is such a structurally complex conversation. You have to understand the code so much. I'd have to talk to somebody that really knows those code bases to figure
that out.
And
also having two completely separate projects can spur innovation.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it can push things forward. It can make, exactly.
So it's like within 1 week, we lost one rendering engine and gained another rendering engine.
We got another one.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. And
you can tell we're
kind
of HTML geeks, can't you?
Well, it's kind of a sweet little story.
Yeah.
You know?
Thanks.
In a lot of ways, too, you're taking WebKit and you're, by forking it and having WebKit and Blink, you're able to streamline for the different browsers based off of the same project. So instead of having this gargantuan thing, you've got this streamlined thing over here called Blink that runs, you know, this really well, and then you've got WebKit over here.
And to be clear, other people are reliant on the WebKit engine, not just these ones we're talking about, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a lot of Adobe uses it, BlackBerry uses it, Intel, Nokia, Samsung, and other groups are using the WebKit engine, and some of them use V8 JavaScript, some of them don't use JavaScript at all in it, and these things are used kind of all over the place, because what we're seeing, like, you know, the most recent version of Microsoft's Windows is actually basically a giant HTML rendering engine, right? So a lot of the applications we see are actually rendered in HTML, and therefore they're using something like WebKit to do that. And that's kind of interesting, even if they're not even using a JavaScript engine. Mm-hmm. So these decisions affect a larger community, and it will go slow, as I think software development sometimes does. But since there's, you know, Google and Apple kind of leading the charge on these things, there'll be enough developers spending time on it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Huh. Now, if you are not a developer, you don't have to worry about this. This doesn't really affect you particularly. Yeah. But if you're a web developer, it's pretty big news. Another thing is, I mean, if you look at Gecko, which is the Firefox rendering engine, it's not just used for Firefox. It's
right.
used for pretty much every product that Mozilla has anything to do with.
And other people.
What's it called? Thunderbird, the mail client that Mozilla has,
that's been out.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like when you talk about web rendering engines, like you were saying, it's not just the things that render websites.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a rendering engine that could render applications or even an operating system. So,
right.
pretty important, especially in this day and age.
I agree. I agree. Bonnie, what do you think?
I, as a mediator, am just impressed that there's, you know, just that the way forward appears to be collaboration. That makes me very happy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I think that's one of the reasons I have such an optimistic view on humanity, because mm-hmm. looking at the software space and going, wow, they're going to remove 6.5 million lines of code. Where'd that come from? Oh my gosh, that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And that's done collaboratively and with agreement to some degree with among people that work for different companies and mm-hmm. different
probably
philosophies.
Probably the best chance of it happening successfully. Really.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that kind of stuff can happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of...
My little heart is warmed.
Did we talk about jQuery 1.9 2.0?
No.
Just really briefly, this is a month or something ago, but jQuery 1.9 and 2.0 are coming out. 2.0 is not going to support Internet Explorer version 8 or below, which means that they can tear out a whole bunch of code that's only there to make things work for those older browsers.
And not just Internet Explorer 8 and below, but other browsers that we're supporting as well.
That's true. But
should
I mean,
we go into the detail of what that meant, Bonnie?
No.
Nope.
Okay, good. I like having authority in the room for that kind of... Nope, we don't need to go into what jQuery things are. Okay.
We may move on.
Let's talk about, because we haven't done it in, I don't know, quite a while. I haven't even said the word for, I don't know, 20 minutes. Facebook. What's the Facebook story
word?
This week?
Now for your Facebook moment.
You need to have a jingle.
We should have a jingle for the Facebook section.
Ben, what'd they do this week?
It happens every week, doesn't it?
It does. It's kind of sad.
So Facebook just announced a new application called Home for Android smartphones. And before I can really explain what this is, I need to explain what a home screen is. So for those of you who have iPhones, you don't really have a connection to this. But Android users, when you press the home button on your phone, it brings up what you think of as the home screen. And you might think of the home screen as part of the operating system, right? So the system that lets you do everything on your phone is not an app, it's part of your operating system.
For an iOS person like me, the home screen you're talking about is like where all the icons are the main button. And, yeah. And you have a Microsoft phone, right?
Yeah, I've got a Windows phone, so it'd be where all the tiles are.
That you launch things with.
My mail is in Twitter.
The starting place, what we used to call a desktop in the desktop machine mm-hmm. space. Okay.
I just have to take a moment and acknowledge the fact that we have an iPhone, an Android, and a Windows phone. All in the same room. Oh, man. There's a smackdown after this.
I'm using Chrome right now, but I want to be using Firefox. Ben? Chrome? On your laptop?
Oh, yeah.
Chrome.
Chrome all the way.
Oh, no. Okay. I'll switch to Firefox this week.
Have fun.
And Bonnie's got to do IE. That's right.
No,
you can do
don't make
you
me.
Okay, Ben.
Okay, so in any case, so basically, what Android has allowed you to do is it's modular enough that you can actually download a different home screen. So there are several home screens out there you can download, and these home screens are, of course, where you launch apps from, where you have widgets, all of that fun stuff, right?
I suddenly got creeped out.
Why?
Facebook's going to know which home screens we're using and
no.
gather
Facebook,
data based on that.
Facebook wants to be your home screen. So that sounds fun.
This morning when Ben said the story, I was like, oh, I hope Bonnie goes, yeah.
So yeah.
The official sound of me being creeped out.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Well,
so Facebook's got a new home screen app, is what you're saying?
At the beginning of the show, we mentioned this at the beginning of the show, every week. These are our opinions,
yes,
not that of KUSP or
right.
anyone
no.
else.
No.
This scares me so much because it's basically, if you don't care about your privacy or data, you know, any of that at all.
Hey, kids.
Then sure, you know, download Facebook Home. Now, to be honest, I haven't used it, so I really can't speak to it. At the same time, I'm not sure that I will use it because it means that I need to link up my phone with Facebook in a really tight way. I don't trust that Facebook will let me go if I link it up, even just for a second. So, but in any case, I mean, for people who are really big Facebook users and trust Facebook maybe a little bit more than me, maybe a little
then
less pessimistic
should.
Than me, you can check this out. It's either coming out very, very shortly or it's already out. But they've submitted it, they've announced it and everything.
Is it that hard to get to Facebook that you need another tool for them to know more about you so that you save a step getting to Facebook?
Well,
I mean, is that all it's for?
There are people who live and breathe Facebook. Not me, but there are people who live and breathe Facebook. So it makes sense to turn your phone into a Facebook portal, if you will.
And, so they've also released an ad for this, which we all have to watch, of course.
Do we?
Yeah, supposedly it's a really good ad. And here's the...
Okay.
I haven't watched it yet.
Wait, is this the rumor about a Facebook phone that I'm hearing about?
Yeah, this is... So for a while we've been talking... There's been talk about Facebook releasing a phone. This is a pretty close example of what that would be. I mean, because basically once you take over the launch application, the home page of a phone, you know what apps are being launched, right? So you're going to know quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But also, you have to log in... To use your phone, you have to be attached to Facebook. So everything you're doing... So it's basically a Facebook phone. It's one way of describing a Facebook phone. They're not going to release hardware, most likely. There's no reason to. But they all have to do
not
is...
Not if they could take over right. that way.
But here's, I love this quote. This ad is great, but not because... This is a quote from... And I'll give you the person's name in just a second. Not because it makes me instantly want to have Facebook Home on my Android phone. I would rather shave my eyebrows with a lawnmower while lying... but while laying underpanted in my neighbor's garden.
Underpanted.
I love the phrase. whose article is this? This is Chris Matiski. I'll link to it from geekspeak.org. But basically, it's a discussion about the ad being really awesome. Yeah. And the thing is, a lot of people, the main app they use on their phone, they use it to make phone calls and to text and use Facebook, right? Those are the things they do. And then the games they play. So it's not going to matter. People will do it, right?
People will do it, just not me. I'm sorry if I'm giving a really pessimistic read of this.
It makes me want to hear from any GeekSpeak listeners who are genuinely enthused about this idea and why they think it's a good one, because I'm baffled.
Yeah, write to us.
I'm genuinely baffled why someone would want to give Facebook that much control.
To me, it's more about the history of Facebook with privacy. Facebook doesn't exactly have a stellar record when it comes to user privacy.
Well, that's not what they're for. Let's just admit that that's not what Facebook is for.
Oh, absolutely. But
they have no interest in guarding privacy. They have exactly the opposite interest.
That's true.
Okay, so what it's going to do, though, you know, when you're in Facebook, you're going to look at photos, and you're also going to look at contacts, you're going to look at the streams. There's all these different features of Facebook, and we think of it as all inside Facebook. If instead you pull that up to the homepage, and now you have your Facebook photos and your Facebook, you start looking at them as it starts looking more like a platform of spaces. So when you want to look at photos, you click on the photos application. So it basically is kind of it does that as well. It wraps it around. Also, your contacts for the phone are your Facebook contacts, right? It integrates your device with your community online. If Facebook didn't have such a gritty taste in my mouth, I'd be like, oh yeah, I see. Right, but the truth is, Apple does the same thing. Right, Apple has iCloud, and iCloud syncs your bookmarks, and syncs your documents, and syncs your contacts and your photos, and they're controlling that space through this kind of horrible service of iCloud. And I say horrible because there's some really fundamentally flawed ways of doing that.
But they're trying to do
something kind of complicated, the syncing aspect of it. But in any case, so when you're on an iOS device, if you have that feature set on, it's very convenient and wonderful and easy, and you use multiple devices and they sync together, and that's all using Apple. And this one's just using Facebook.
And
it's not really that different.
Right now with my Android phone, I'm using all the Google services. So, right. I mean, you know, the only difference is I trust Google more than I trust
Because they're not evil.
I hate the idea. Oh,
just
stop
because
it.
They put, we swear we're not evil in their mission statement.
No.
Which no bad guy would ever think of.
But
Bob, you're not evil.
I would rather not trust any company, right? Just trust. But at some point, you kind of have to. If you want to use services like email, you have to choose someone to trust with your email. So,
okay, so you're going to start hearing a kick from me over the next, I don't know, month or so, maybe longer. Sometimes I hold on to ideas for longer than that. To say the company to trust is Firefox, is Mozilla, because Mozilla is a nonprofit, right? So like there's that dear closeness to my heart working with all these nonprofits in my life.
True. Yeah,
but then again, who knows?
But then who knows what they're up to?
Right. I do have to say
nonprofit.
I have to say one positive thing because I've been so negative about the story. I have no doubt that Facebook can make a really, really good user experience using their new home screen app. I have no doubt that it can be a really fantastic experience, especially if you're ingrained and invested in Facebook. It's just other things that bother me. So I just want to put that out there. And I'm sure that the work they've done is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I do have an Android device, which is not a primary device for me. I'm just using it from work right now just to play with it. It's a Nexus 7. And I will try the Facebook Home thing to see what it's like. Because why not? That'd be kind of fun.
All right.
Have fun with it.
This is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe, also Bonnie Jean Primsch.
Sure,
we got some more awesome Scared of Robots on Facebook. And we're going to hear a little bit about Kepler. We're going to hear a little bit about, well, a new comet, potentially. More geek news in just a minute. So stay with us.
If you're up for a little more quality listening here on KUSP, you can tune into the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at noon. As a poor kid growing up in the Bronx, Leonard Susskind planned to follow his father's footsteps working as a plumber, but he became a physicist instead. Sometimes those dreams just don't come true. Today, he's considered one of the leading thinkers of his generation, a co-discoverer of string theory and other core concepts of modern physics. Leonard Susskind talks to KUSP's Robert Pauly about his humble beginnings, where his ideas come from, and why he loves to explain physics to non-experts. Plumbing the Universe on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at noon here on KUSP.
We hope that GeekSpeak every week engages your mind with ideas and concepts. And one of the support systems we do is we provide more stories for you up at geekspeak.org. So when you get excited by what we're talking about, please do feel free to go to geekspeak.org. You just have to find the show page. They're pretty well listed, kind of like a blog. And up there is videos, of course, of the Boston Dynamics robot called Petman. And also, of course, a great little video on the development team talking about Blink, this WebKit Blink's the thing, if you want to get more technical about that. Also, I want to recommend this one wonderful little geek madness, a showdown of technologists and science geeks. So basically, on one side, imagine like a playoff chart of like basketball teams, right? So on one side, you have technology, and under there, a whole bunch of course, amazing technologists, right? We got Bill Gates, and we got Alan Turing.
Big gun people.
And then on the right hand side is math and science, and we got Albert Einstein, and we've got Benjamin Franklin, Galileo, and so on. And so what they did is they teamed up like Albert Einstein versus Ben Franklin, right? And then who won that? Well, Einstein won. And then the next set would be Galileo versus somebody else, and then they would fight, right? So you basically
battle
around.
Is this like celebrity boxing match?
It's like celebrity boxing. It's basically
popular vote
completely. Who's the greatest geek of ever? And the competition right now has come down to the technologist side, Alan Turing, who basically invented computer terminology, and Linus Torvalds, who is the person behind Linux operating system and also the Git source control system.
If it were boxing, Torvalds would definitely win because he's still alive.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's not
it's
boxing.
Easier to box when all and the Linus popularity. Are still.
Linus right now is actually winning above Alan Turing. So,
whoa,
Then on the science and math side, you have Nikola Tesla, who is kind of insane mad scientist, awesome guy.
Nikola
Tesla. And Albert Einstein, who, of course, we know.
Who is that guy?
Yeah. So, and currently, Tesla is winning. So, if you want to vote for your favorite, go to geekspeak.org and just click on that wonderful link about who is the greatest geek of all time. All right.
I'm really
and also, there's more information about that.
There, you know, Tesla's there, and it's not Edison.
Yeah.
Edison was kind of a butthead.
Yeah,
that's
when,
a tired
I wonder
match.
When that one won, when he won. It was early on.
Was Edison on the list originally?
Why is that? Edison has to be up
he
there,
must
right?
Have been.
No, Edison's a butthead. Sorry.
Not, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't like
Edison's
Edison.
Not on
the
there.
Current prevailing theory.
Cool. Edison
kind of
didn't even make the list of the top 15.
Wonderful.
Ooh,
wow.
Take that.
Because, I mean, you know, the U.S. power plug is named after Edison. Why? It should be named after Tesla. Tesla was so much more awesome, and he was a much better man.
Really?
Yeah, Edison
was
a
better human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, straight
yeah,
that's
better.
Why I'm...
No, there's no judgment here. This is factual
but
information.
But have They Might Be Giants written a song about Tesla?
That's true.
Well, he would electrocute animals to show that direct current was dangerous, or that alternating current was dangerous, and that direct current, what he was...
Edison was doing this.
Edison was saying direct current all the way, and Tesla was like...
Didn't Edison, like, kill an elephant with the...
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And many, many cats. He would tour around and go to fairs and electrocute live animals.
Burgers.
Like, I hate that man.
Point.
I hate that man. Yeah. And it wasn't because his ideas were
I didn't
better.
Mean to have this like 20-minute rant on Edison.
Okay. Hey, so I got a geek bit.
Yes, Edison hater.
To change the subject. I'm reading a fantastic book right now, and this is only going to be interesting to Star Trek people, so I'll make it quick. But if you watch Star Trek Deep Space Nine, there's a character named Garak. He's a Cardassian, and it's
Garak,
a very, very deep character.
That guy's got a neck.
He's mysterious. Yeah. Kind of a nice neck, actually.
Yeah. Bonnie's into Cardassian necks.
Gold Dukat had a much... Mark Alamo, whatever his name is. His neck is epically long. But anyway...
It's the width I'm talking about. The shoulder width of the
neck.
Yeah,
the Cardassian
neck
muscles.
Both length and width kind of matter. So
anyway, yeah. Ben? Google Cardassian, not Kardashian. Cardassian, and you'll see what we mean. Anyway, Andrew J. Robinson, the guy who played Garak on Star Trek, wrote a book about Garak. and about Cardassian culture and society and the character's history.
We cannot stress this enough. Cardassian, not Kardashian.
Yeah, those are different.
Very, very different.
You totally know what? Different
actually,
next.
You know what happened, actually? when the Kardashians were new in the news, like popular enough but new in the news, I don't really follow celebrity news, and I kept hearing about Kardashians, but they were
right.
They were mispronouncing it. They were saying Kardashians, and I'm like, why are people talking about Kardashian perfume?
Star
that doesn't
Trek.
Make any sense.
Yeah, it does. They're a sophisticated
like
culture.
And they have perfume?
So, what they probably would, but I mean, why would that be?
Noses.
Why would that be here on Earth?
Yes,
that doesn't make it. So I got confused.
Kardashian is an alien space race popularized by Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, exactly.
Popularized. That's very sweet.
By Deep Space Nine, one of the less popular of the Star Trek series, which I think is better than The Next Generation. I'm bracing
for
that.
You promised this would be short.
All right, anyway.
You gave us warning.
The book that I love, this book is called A Stitch in Time, and it's by Andrew J. Robinson, and it's absolutely fantastic if you're a Star Trek
fan. Okay, are you partially through it? Are you listening to it?
Yeah,
or reading it?
No, I'm reading it, and I'm 47% through it, I think. What? Well, how
digitally
would I,
reading it.
How would I know that if I had a physical book, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to assume you're halfway through.
I counted the pages.
If you had a physical book, you wouldn't know you were about halfway through, because how could you possibly tell?
I said
the bookmark might not be in the middle.
Okay, stop trolling. I said 47%. I didn't
say
halfway.
Do you know that paper books actually have page numbers? They have page numbers, so you can figure it out.
Wait a minute, what?
What?
I know it's strange to think.
My Kindle says however many 47%. Hours left in the book. It doesn't say however many pages. This is hours. I thought you mentioned
this current speeding reading rate.
Yeah, it changes. So anyway,
what's the book called? A Stitch in Time.
A Stitch in Time. Yeah.
And it's what's the real guy's name?
It's about Andrew J. Robinson. Yeah,
Andrew Robinson.
About his character Garrick. And it's yeah. Anyway, so if you're a Star Trek fan, you're probably really interested right now. If you're not a Star Trek fan, you're probably exceedingly bored right now. So
no, they just think you guys are cute with all of your Star Trek.
That's
alia.
Right.
Yeah, it's your look at him go. Look at the geeks geeking.
Deep Space Nine. Do we have enough, sit where no one has sat before.
Do we have enough time to cover the next two stories? I'll cover them really fast.
What time
is
it?
Like how many minutes do I have? 2 minutes?
You have one, six. You one? Have less than 4 minutes.
Do I? Okay, great. So anyway, the Kepler satellite, what the Kepler satellite does is it orbits the Earth and it looks at all these stars and it checks to see if any of the light from the stars dips. And the idea is if any planets pass in front of the stars, exoplanets, planets really far away, we can't observe it optically. But if we see the light output of the star dim, it's probably because a planet is passing in front of the star. And if we see it dim over and over and over again at a nice regular period,
then we have a sense of orbits.
Yeah, we have a sense that there's a planet orbiting a star way far out, and we've discovered a lot of exoplanets that way. So we discovered a transit in the KOI 256 system, which, you know, astronomers are really great at naming things. So the researchers at Caltech were like, huh, okay, this seems like a massive planet. But it was a little bit, the data was a little bit weird. And so what they did is they looked at the star's wobble and did some fancy schmancy stuff. We talked about it on previous
sure.
episodes.
They applied the science.
Techniques. And they discovered that it's actually a white dwarf going around this star. So it's
ooh.
It's a white dwarf star orbiting a much bigger star. And it's a pretty interesting article because I don't have any time. I'm not going to cover more of
but
it.
We'll but we'll have it on geekspeak.org.
I will put it on geekspeak.org.
Yeah. Okay, next story.
Lastly, on November 28th, there will be a comet, which is approaching the sun. Its orbit appears to indicate that it hasn't gone by the sun before. And it's going to swoop really, really close to the sun. It's going to get to the closest point to the sun on November 28th. We'll probably see it. It's not going to hit Earth or anything, so don't worry
about
that.
Is it going to get inside of Earth's orbit around the sun?
It will. Oh, you know cool. how close it'll get?
Hmm.
The distance of the moon to the Earth, it's going to get 3 times that distance to the sun.
Whoa. Wait, what's the sun's actual, I mean, where is the boundary that we talk about the sun being the sun? I mean, it's a gaseous thing. So.
I don't have a number off.
Sorry, a plasmic thing.
Yeah, that's true.
No, it's not, thanks again to
they might be giants.
They might be giants.
Thanks for the update, guys.
Yeah, but I mean, it's going to pass within. It's going to pass at about 1.2 million kilometers, which is really, 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 really close. It's going to be traveling at about 1 million miles an hour.
Do we know much about what its material is? Is it a
it's
cold
a
thing?
A lot of ice,
mm-hmm.
And so, but it's big enough that it's actually going to survive this.
Oh,
it's
cool.
Going to like
what?
Get really close, and it's probably going to blow out tons and tons of material.
So right
and water.
Now, it's going the direction where its tail looks like it's traveling the correct direction, and when it leaves the sun, its tail will inverse, of course, and then it'll be all confusing.
Yeah, maybe
backwards.
If we have enough time on another show, we'll talk about that. But yeah, the tail always points away from the star. that it's about to orbit. It's kind of fun.
Huh. You know what? You still have a minute or so. You got another one?
Okay. Well, yeah, just about that. It might outshine Venus. It might be that bright in the sky.
So look out for it.
So when is the middle of November? Is that what you said?
Middle of November is when it's going to get closest to the sun. I'm going to cover this probably sometime.
We'll cover it again.
Every time on GeekSpeak.
Yeah, every single time on GeekSpeak.
Now for your new comment moment.
So, yeah, anyway, that's kind of fun.
Awesome.
And also, Apple devices are going to outsell Windows devices for the first time in 2013. So that's iPads, iPhones, Macs.
So far, Apple has not done that yet.
No.
It's all Microsoft's still been selling Windows stuff.
There are a lot of Windows devices that are being sold.
Even though Bonnie bought a Windows phone this year.
Yeah, tablets and phones, but especially also Windows machines. I mean, think about how many big businesses
are. There's a lot of Windows computers. So, so what we're basically seeing is the switch from desktop and laptop space to these tablet and phones being a bigger sale. Apple's dominated that space for quite a while on volume compared to Microsoft, not compared necessarily to other vendors.
Absolutely.
But now we're basically seeing that Apple's in or Microsoft's losing to Apple. It's pretty amazing. Yeah,
pretty crazy.
Very cool. Well, you are listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Bonnie Jean Primsch. Thank you both for being here today.
This was fun.
Yeah, it was very fun.
And everything we talk about, we close up the air room in just a few seconds, and then we put all this stuff, make sure it's up on geekspeak.org. So please do visit geekspeak.org. You can send us email there too. Thanks for listening this week on KUSP. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.